Welcome to Metro Connection. I'm Rebecca Scheer, and this week we're bringing you stories from one of our region's oldest highways, Route 1. Route 1 was formally created as part of the U.S. highway system in 1926, though parts of it were around years before that. The highway runs nearly 2,400 miles from the U.S.-Canadian border in Maine to Key West, Florida. Today, we're going to cover about 90 miles of that stretch, from Elk Ridge, Maryland, down to Fredericksburg, Virginia. In between, we'll hit a bunch of spots, including College Park, the District of Columbia, and Fairfax County. We'll also look at long-running efforts to redevelop the road, and hear why some people say those efforts are starting to bear fruit. Now, Route 1 goes by a lot of different names, depending where you are. Up in Elk Ridge, Maryland, it's often known as Washington Boulevard. And the first place we'll visit on today's show is Washington Boulevard Marketplace, or the US 1 Flea Market, as some people call it. Although anyone can shop there, it's become one of the central gathering places for our region's burgeoning Hispanic community. Emily Berman takes us along for a tour.
From the outside, the marketplace looks like a bunch of big box stores stuck together. But once you get out of the car, it's nothing like pulling up to Best Buy. Spanish language music plays on the loudspeakers, and before I get inside the building, Luis Diaz comes up and hands me his business card. He owns a restaurant just down Route 1.
It's called Maria's Bajas Cafe. It's just pretty much like a Tex-Mex food and Salvadorian, you know, pupusas. And a lot of people call me from this place to do delivery.
For this early in the morning, he's had a lot of orders, especially for winter. But to really see this place in action, he says, come in the middle of the summer. The parking lot will be full of vendors.
Like in the summertime, along this parking lot, they have like live chickens, eggs, little pigs, pigeons in like cages.
People come from Delaware, Pennsylvania, Virginia, not to mention DC and Baltimore. It's becoming just the bustling marketplace Michael Brown was hoping to create when he took over the business 15 years ago.
Our customer base is loyal. Whether they have money to spend or not, they'll be here.
As Brown and I walk around, he explains that the crowd used to be mainly black and white. Nowadays, the market is about 75% Latino run. Each shop has a story to tell about the community. The tool shop, for example, is packed with used hand drills and heavy leather belts. Day laborers need their own set of tools, and in the off-season, many go to their home country.
What are they going to do with their tools? They're not going to leave them. They're not maintaining a residence, more than likely, so they're going to sell them before they go. When they come back, they've got to buy them again.
Next, we pass a glass storefront with elaborately decorated cowboy boots. The most expensive ones are $2,000. There are lingerie shops, secondhand shoes, and jewelry stores. Brown and I pause in front of a used appliance shop.
Well, when you Home Depot comes and you buy a brand new refrigerator or stove, and they got free haul away, that's where it comes. It goes out and gets cleaned up, repaired if it needs to be repaired, and then it's sold to a clientele that maybe can't afford a new refrigerator at Home Depot or Best Buy.
But it's not all working-class families who shop here. Sergio Quiros is ordering food for his wife and daughter, who are waiting at a table nearby. They don't come here for appliances or cowboy boots. They come for the food.
We ordered a menudo, 6 carne asada tacos without onions, and orange jarritos, and a Coke. It's kind of what we always order.
The Quiros family lives in Clarksville, one of the most expensive corners of Howard County. If you're looking for authentic Mexican tacos or menudo, Quiros says you have to come to the flea market.
I'm from California, and it's a dish that we eat every Sunday. So it's beef tripe, which is the intestines, and then they cut it up, and it's a soup.
The Washington Boulevard Marketplace is emblematic of Hispanic life in Howard County. The Hispanic population here is economically very diverse, according to Feli Sola Carter.
I'm a native of Puerto Rico, and I reside in Ellicott City.
Sola Carter is a community organizer and advocate for Hispanic students in Howard County Public Schools. According to the Pew Research Center, there are nearly 1 million Hispanics in the D.C. Baltimore region. In Howard County, Hispanics make up 6% of the population and nearly 10% of public school students. Along Route 1, Sola Carter explains, there's a higher concentration of working-class families. That's where you can find affordable housing and easy access to highways. But further west in the county, there are professionals from many Latin American countries, particularly from Puerto Rico.
For the folks who are here, who have, especially those who have had a very challenging time simply making it here, these are extremely resilient individuals who will put in whatever hours it takes to be successful.
People like the Lopez family. They're four brothers from Mexico and all spend their weekends at the flea market. One of the Lopez kids, Daisy, runs her own toy store.
I like when, like how people, when they buy stuff, they feel a bit happy. They feel happy that their parents buy it.
Her talent for sales is no surprise. She grew up at the market. When she was a baby, there was no one to watch her at home, so she'd come here. Most of her extended family works here.
Then my uncle, sure. And my mom, then my other aunt over there. She sells some t-shirts for sports.
Daisy's mom runs a perfume shop just across the aisle from the toy store, so she keeps an eye on what's happening. Many of the younger cousins help out at Daisy's store.
So who works in this store?
Me.
Me.
Are you guys in Daisy's store?
Yeah.
Good enough.
Being here is a lot like being in an old-fashioned Latin American marketplace. Families stroll and shop, kids run around and spend time with their friends. It's comfortable, Daisy says, just like home. I'm Emily Berman.
We have an interactive map showing the Washington Boulevard marketplace and all the spots we'll visit on today's show on our website, metroconnection.org. If you leave the hustle and bustle of the Washington Boulevard Marketplace and you head south on Route 1, within a few miles you'll come to the Day Resource Center. The organization is run by local churches and helps people who are struggling in Howard County, Maryland, where the median income is nearly $110,000 a year. Kavitha Cardoza stopped by the center earlier this week to learn more about the hidden problem of poverty in one of the wealthiest counties in the nation, and she joins me now. Hi, Kavitha.
Hi, Rebecca. So the easiest way to tell the story is to introduce you to Melinda Becker. She runs the Route 1 Day Resource Center.
We are standing on the southbound side of Route 1 in Jessup, Maryland. Route 1 is very busy. It is an industrial corridor as well as residential corridor. We are in this location because we found that the majority of the homeless population was in this area.
She started out as a volunteer when her church got involved in the center's operations 7 years ago. She used to go into the woods to hand out food to homeless people camping there.
And how has she seen the center evolve since then? How has she seen it grow?
Well, these days, there's a network of approximately 30 churches and synagogues whose volunteers provide hot meals, do laundry, and pick up homeless residents who need to come into the center for medical care or a shower. And people also bring in donations, everything from shampoo to socks and underclothes to winter coats.
And what about the people who come to the center to take advantage of its resources? Tell us more about them.
Well, at the day center, most people were white. And I think there's this misconception, Rebecca, that only minorities are poor in this region. Another misconception is that you'll be able to tell if someone's poor. But lots of people who came into the day center were very nicely dressed. Another misconception is that the homeless are only those living on the streets. And it's really everyone from the chronically homeless, the newly homeless, those sleeping on someone's sofa, or even the working poor who might have a job but not enough to cover their basic living expenses. One of the people I met was Tammy Gamine-Weiser. She's been coming here for years for food.
Some ranch dressing, some Spam, and we get some water. You know, I think I'm going to skip the chips. I mean, I've been with my husband 34 years. Our apartment caught on fire. And we didn't have insurance. We've been living in a motel for 3 years.
How much does it cost?
$58 a night, and I don't have today's rent, so that's not a good subject right now.
How do you support yourselves?
He takes all jobs he can get. Yard work, I do cleaning, and also we panhandle up in Burtonsville when we have to. but we didn't have a ride up there today, so I don't know what we're going to do tonight.
Tammy says she's also been coming to the center for medicine.
So medicine, food, what are some of the other things people are most in need of when they come to the center?
Well, Melinda Becker asks clients what their needs are, say a frying pan, so she can match them with donations or seek contributions through a site like Facebook.
Everybody has to put in a tent request. It's a high dollar item. We had one guy who he was camping up in Jessup, and there was a bank robbery, and the criminal ran into the woods, and the police followed him in, and they came upon Mike's camp, and they tore his tent up, thinking he was the guy. Mike knew that I wouldn't give him another one, so the police wrote him a note. And he came down here and he handed me the note from the Howard County Police that said, please excuse Mike's tent. We thought he was a bank robber and we tore it up. Please give him another one. It was the I wish I had kept that.
That's not a story you hear every day.
Definitely not. Most of the stories I heard were about more day-to-day struggles. There's a real need for these services here in Howard County. The county only has one general emergency shelter in Columbia.
Well, let's look ahead to the future now, Kavitha. What's in store for the Route 1 Day Resource Center? Does it have adequate funding? Does it have enough space?
Well, there's actually good news on that front. The county has given the Day Resource Center 8 acres of land close by, and in a year and a half, they hope to have a brand new, larger building with 35 efficiency apartments for clients.
Well, Kavitha Cardoza, thank you for giving us a glimpse at this slice of life on Route 1.
Thanks for having me.
If you live or work on Route 1, whether in Maryland, D.C., or Virginia, we would love to hear your stories. You can reach us at metro@wamu.org or on Twitter. Our handle is @WAMUMetro. And we have a map that shows all the places we're visiting on Route 1 today. You can check it out on our website, metroconnection.org. After the break, we'll take Route 1 into the nation's capital and visit a neighborhood that's generating big-time buzz.
People look at Capitol Hill and go, oh my God, that's ridiculously expensive. And then they go to Brookland and what do you mean? No houses are for sale. And then they come to Woodridge.
That story and more is coming your way on Metro Connection here on WAMU 88.5.
WAMU news coverage of labor and employment issues is made possible by your contributions and by Matthew Watson, in memory of Marjorie Watson. And support for WAMU 88.5's coverage of the environment comes from the Wallace Genetic Foundation, dedicated to the promotion of farmland preservation, the reduction of environmental toxins, and the conservation of natural resources.
I'm Rebecca Shear, and welcome back to Metro Connection. This week, we're taking a ride on the longest north-south motorway in the country as we road trip down Route 1. We started off in Elkridge, Maryland, at an indoor flea market run by the area's growing Hispanic community. Later in the hour, we'll zoom on down to Virginia and visit the only town in America that's completely surrounded by a military base. But for now, we're going to stick around the old line state a little bit longer and head to a city on Route 1 that was officially chartered 70 years ago. College Park.
Today, the city has over 30,000 residents who live in 11 different neighborhoods around the campus.
That campus is the University of Maryland, and the voice is that of University President Wallace Lowe. He's talking in a promotional video for new students showing various events and offerings in College Park.
Be good neighbors, because when the city prospers, the university prospers too.
But as President Lowe recently told me during an interview in his office, he doesn't think the city has been prospering of late. And much of that has to do with the development, or lack of development, on Route 1.
This university has grown dramatically over the past 20, 25 years to become a top 20 public research university. I think its future growth, to the extent it is constrained, it is not by internal factors, but by the surrounding community. Meaning, most of our faculty and staff no longer live here as they did a generation ago. Most of them commute to Montgomery County and Howard County and D.C., and many of our graduate students don't live in College Park.
I heard that it was only like 3% of faculty and students who live in the area.
Yes, today. And a generation ago, it was 30 to 35%. Basically, if you look at all the top-ranked public research universities, they're also in top-ranked university towns. There is a synergy between the two. And so, therefore, we can no longer think about the continuing rise of the University of Maryland independently of the community of which it is a part.
In September, students and staff got together to talk about improving Route 1 at the Arts and Humanities College's Center for Synergy Thinkathon. And Sherry Parks, the Associate Dean for Research, Interdisciplinary Scholarship and Programming at the college's Center for Synergy, she said students, quote, want to be able to do things on Route 1 besides drink and eat pizza. Do you feel that's a fair way to characterize Route 1 as it stands right now?
Well, certainly that is one of the aspects that needs to be improved. There have to be amenities other than fast food and bars.
How do you do that?
It takes time, but it's the following. Number one, you have to make Route 1 more pedestrian safe, and you have to address the issue of the overall safety of the community, which we have done working with the State Department of Transportation to reduce speed, to have barriers between the two sides of Route 1, and new traffic lights. Number two, we have significantly increased the number of police officers and patrol cars and cameras that we have. And then you need to have the housing and the amenities. Of course, bars is just one component of it, but there are other kinds of multiple use developments that need to occur, and they are starting to appear in College Park.
Well, I know a lot of hotel rooms are in the works.
Yes, we have somewhere around 300,000 to 400,000 visitors to College Park. Most of them stay overnight, at least one night. We have many conferences, conventions, and where are they held? Well, Baltimore or Washington, D.C.
That's a problem.
That is, in terms of the economic impact it could have on this community. I mean, even on football days, Ohio State brings 15,000 fans. And there's no place for them to stay in College Park. And so we're looking within a time frame of 4 years or so, when we'll have a hotel and conference center. That alone will bring in 400 full-time jobs. At the base of that hotel in this garage, there will be space for something like 10 different innovation incubators. And they can be also art studios. So it's not just a hotel and conference center. It will catalyze development along Route 1, and specifically, it will catalyze our vision for an innovation district. Right next to the hotel, we are going to be building the EREAP Center for Innovation and Computer Science, which will have many, many other innovation spaces for the creation of startup companies. You have that, plus the innovation space across the street and the hotel, and then we're creating this ecosystem of startup companies. These startup companies with young people, this is what's going to keep them in Maryland, help create jobs, and drive the economic development of the state, certainly of this region. And for that, you have to have the amenities. You have to have the coffee shops and the restaurants and places to go beside bars. So we are, for example, looking at establishing an art house where there are poetry slams, there are international films, there's food, there's wine that's served in very attractive setting on Route 1 itself.
So when you mentioned before that it used to be that, you know, a third of the faculty, staff, and students lived here, and now it's more like 3%, how soon before we get back up to a third, if not more?
Well, it isn't going to happen overnight, but we believe people will start coming back to College Park because it's also a place for culture and other activities. College Park is on the move.
Well, President Lowe, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me.
Thank you.
That was Wallace Lowe, president of the University of Maryland. And regarding that Center for Synergy Thinkathon, where people were brainstorming ideas for developing Route 1 in College Park, if you want to join the conversation, the UMD Center for Synergy Collaboration welcomes your thoughts. We have a link at metroconnection.org. Our next stop on today's trip down Route 1 takes us through Mount Rainier, across the Maryland District Line, and into the D.C. neighborhood of Woodridge. That's where Route 1 becomes Rhode Island Avenue Northeast. For years, many of the storefronts along this stretch have been shuttered and abandoned, and residents have had to go elsewhere for groceries or a cup of coffee. But as Tara Boyle tells us, that's changing. Fast.
It's dinner time on Rhode Island Avenue Northeast, and that means it's time to crack some lobsters. Oliver Friendly is standing at the table in his catering kitchen, using a mallet to expertly crack open lobsters.
Perfect.
There are days that I love my job. Most days, actually.
Friendly is the chef and owner of Eat and Smile Catering. He can cook hundreds of meals at a time in this commercial kitchen, but he also just started hosting dinners here for 8 people at a time. He calls these events the Bespoke Kitchen Supper Club.
So we're doing 8 tasting courses. We're doing a local Rappahannock oyster with pickled red onion and smoked salt. And then we're doing beet tartare, pickled mustard seed, goat cheese, and baby kale, because kale.
It'll take him a while to get through that menu, so trust me when I say it's delicious, labor-intensive food.
And then we're doing celeriac soup, lobster, grapefruit, parsley, and pickled mustard seed again.
Friendly Supper Club is a high-end concept, the sort of place you'd be more likely to see in Shaw or on H Street Northeast. And so you might be thinking this is a traditional tale of gentrification, yet another sign of the demographic shift that's changing neighborhoods all over this city. But people who live and work in this part of Ward 5 say what's happening here is a little different, more grassroots.
We originally started out as a group of neighbors that just wanted a coffee shop close by.
That's Woodridge resident Kyle Todd. In 2011, he and his neighbors created an organization called Friends of Rhode Island Avenue.
We knew that development was coming. Rhode Island Avenue is prime. We're surrounded by fantastic development projects throughout the city and in Prince George's County. So we knew things were coming this way, and we wanted to make sure that community members had a voice in what that development looked like.
Todd and other residents started leading monthly cleanups of Rhode Island Avenue. They visited businesses in other parts of town and tried to woo them to their neighborhood. In 2013, the D.C. government chose Friends of Rhode Island Avenue to manage the Rhode Island Avenue Northeast Main Street program. Kyle Todd became the executive director of the new effort. He says his job is to help existing businesses spruce up their properties, mainly through grants. He also helps new businesses just getting started.
We realized there were all these fantastic commercial properties with big wide sidewalks, and many of the places were vacant.
Now those vacant storefronts are starting to fill up. Today, residents have that coffee shop they wanted, Zeke's Coffee. A grocery store, Good Food Market, just opened in January. In May, a new Mediterranean restaurant, Nido, is set to open. And perhaps not surprisingly, the housing market is also starting to take off.
Ooh, beautiful. Oh my gosh, I love it already.
Realtor Daniel Brewer is taking me through a single-family home for sale on 24th Street Northeast.
We have kind of a typical Woodridge-style home. You know, it's an older cottage-style home that they've come in and they've put beautiful brand-new bamboo floors in, put new drywall, it looks like, all brand new windows, recessed lighting.
The asking price? Just under $548,000. Plunk this house down in another part of the city, and Brewer says you could get $900,000 for it. So that makes Woodridge a comparative bargain, part of the reason Washingtonian Magazine just named it one of D.C.'s best neighborhoods in which to buy a home. But housing costs in Woodridge are on the rise. Brewer says the median sale price in January was about a third higher than it was a year earlier.
I just sold another house in December right around the corner for $750,000, and I had 3 open houses. It sold in 2 weeks, and I'd say, you know, a good majority of the people that came by were from the Hill that had small kids. They were going to charter school kind of over in this neighborhood that wanted the yard, that wanted, you know, to be with other small kids, and they saw the potential in the neighborhood.
It's pretty much the same reason Sandy Hassan and her husband, Rusty, moved here more than 40 years ago.
We had kids. We had one daughter at that time, and I was expecting another. And we were looking for good neighborhood schools.
They settled in a cozy house with a fireplace and a front porch and never left. They liked the schools.
And in the beginning, they could run many of their errands on Rhode Island Avenue.
It had Bergman's Laundry. Our bank was there. There was even a Safeway. And slowly but surely, all of those went away.
By the early 2000s, most of those stores were gone. So now, when Sandy and Rusty see new businesses settling on Rhode Island Avenue and new neighbors moving in down the block, they get a little worried about their property taxes inching up. But more than anything, they get excited about what the future may hold and what a new generation of residents will bring to this place.
We're the old-timers now, so, you know, to keep a neighborhood vibrant, you've got to have the kids.
Rusty says they'd both like to see Rhode Island Avenue develop into something of an arts district.
In the 70s, there were clubs on Rhode Island Avenue that featured jazz. There was a Bill Harris's Pigfoot, there was Moore's Love and Peace, and Mr. Wise. And so there was also a club scene similar to other neighborhoods back then that I wouldn't mind seeing closer to home also.
A jazz renaissance may not be in the immediate future for Rhode Island Avenue, but change is coming. One coffee shop, one restaurant, one resident at a time. I'm Tara Boyle.
Our next stop on Route 1 is kind of an unexpected one. Remember how we said the highway changes names depending on where it is? Well, we left off on Rhode Island Avenue, aka Route 1, and from there we'll head southwest on the road till we get to 6th Street Northwest in Shaw. This part of 6th, all the way down to Constitution Avenue, is also technically Route 1. Still with me? Good. All right, so we head south on 6th Street and we eventually hit the National Mall. The north side of the mall is bordered by Constitution Avenue, which is, yes, another name for Route 1. We head west on Constitution. All right, so we are walking on Constitution Avenue, and in this case, we're going by foot. And when we reach 14th Street,
about to hit 14th Street,
two things happen. One, 14th Street becomes Route 1, and two,
turning left,
we arrive at the future site of the museum occupying the last available space on the National Mall.
National Museum of African American History and Culture.
The Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture, to be precise, set to open in 2016. And as program executive Judd McIntyre explains, the 400,000 square foot building will have 5 floors above ground and 4 below.
Over half the building is below grade, and that includes a voluminous history gallery of 3 levels. Visitors will descend through a glass elevator to the lowest level of the history gallery, and then they'll work their way up through the chronology of the exhibit, starting with slavery in the United States through 1968.
Lonnie Bunch is the founding director of the museum. I recently sat down with him in his office atop L'Enfant Plaza, where he explained how the museum came to be at this spot on Route 1, nestled between the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History and the Washington Monument.
It is without a doubt one of the most important parts of my job from the beginning was to figure out where this museum should be. And I felt that the National Mall was the place where millions of Americans and hundreds of thousands of foreign visitors come to learn what it means to be an American. And I thought, where better than that to have a museum that will complete our understanding of who we are, that will challenge our notions of self, that will inspire future generations to be as brave, as courageous as the people whose lives we're studying.
Now, you've said that as a historian, it's your job to help people remember not just what they want to remember, but what they need to remember. How does that idea come into play at the National Museum of African American History and Culture?
In some ways, that idea is played out by attention. Attention between crafting stories that will make you cry over the pain of slavery or segregation, make you feel the loss that was often happening in this community. But the other side of that tension is finding the resiliency, the kind of optimism and hope that undergirded not just this community, but ultimately permeates throughout America and helps shape the American notions of optimism and who we are as a people. So for me, it's finding that balance between pain and the joy of this particular community.
And in terms of bringing that to life, how have you gone about collecting items and artifacts for exhibition?
we decided with good people to create a program called Saving African American Treasures, where we went around the country, helped people preserve grandma's old shawl or that wonderful oval photograph, and people would call and bring amazing things. And one example is, I've got a call, and a guy said, he's got stuff on Harriet Tubman, and I said, no way. He said, well, if you come to Philadelphia, you'll at least see it. So I go to Philadelphia, and this guy opens a box and pulls out photographs of Harriet Tubman no one had ever seen, pulls out her hymnal that had all those spirituals that she sang when she went into the South, Steal Away Jesus, Swing Low Sweet Chariot, had a shawl given to her by Queen Victoria that she's wrapped in 3 days before she died. So I'm crying. And it's that kind of thing where people have almost said they've either waited for this moment, this museum, or maybe more than anything else that humbles me is that they trust us, that they trust the Smithsonian as the place to not have their artifacts, but to have their stories, to have their hearts, to have their lives.
Now, given this ongoing process of amassing items for the museum, how were you able to finalize plans on what it would look like, what the exhibits would be, without knowing everything that would be in it?
Building this museum was like going on a cruise at the same time you're building the ship. You had to learn how to bail, and you had to be nimble. And so what I did in a practical way was, because we didn't have any collections, I said the first couple of months, or maybe the first couple of years, saying, let us interview the public, let us talk to scholars, let's figure out what stories we have to tell. So I actually created, as you can see on this wall, yellow sheets of paper, and I would put down slavery, Reconstruction, civil rights movement, women's work, and we just start to make a list of these stories, and then we'd narrow those down to a reasonable number. And then I said, okay, you know you're going to tell the story of the civil rights movement, but we don't know how. So what you're going to do is look for things that'll tell us that. And this will be a way to actually celebrate not a history, not even a community, but to celebrate America's ability to really illuminate all the dark corners of its past, its ability to sort of have confidence that it can find reconciliation and healing over issues that divided us if only we face them.
That was Lonnie Bunch, founding director of the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture. The museum is set to open in 2016, and you can see renderings of what it will look like on our website, metroconnection.org. In a minute, the early stomping grounds of the father of our country.
The place that is Ferry Farm helps shape the man that George becomes.
It's coming your way as our road trip down Route 1 continues here on Metro Connection on WAMU 88.5. Welcome back to Metro Connection. I'm Rebecca Shear, and today we're taking a road trip as we bring you stories from one of our region's oldest and most eclectic highways, Route 1. We started in the suburbs south of Baltimore, and then we headed down through Maryland and into the district, and now we're going to cross the Potomac River via the 14th Street Bridge and head to Virginia. Now, earlier in the hour, when we visited College Park, Maryland, we heard University of Maryland President Wallace Lowe talk about the need for redeveloping Route 1. Well, in Virginia, people have been calling for the same thing for decades. Jennifer Strong brings us this story on how Route 1 has evolved in the Commonwealth and whether perceptions of the highway match the reality.
On a driving tour of Route 1 in Fairfax County, I'm lost, at times because it's just that different from my last trip over here. Alternately, I'm lost in time, shocked to see some familiar old buildings still open for business. My guide is Edith Kelleher.
Some of these old motels that are here and some of the older uses along the highway that still exist, a lot of people call them cash cows.
Kelleher is the executive director of SFDC, the Southeast Fairfax Development Corporation.
Because the people who own them have had them for decades, their expenses are minimal, and they're making money on them. And so to buy them out with interest rates as low as they are, they want a lot of money.
The nonprofit works to revitalize the highway from the Capitol Beltway to Fort Belvoir. She points out a brightly painted cash lending store.
We're up to 9 now on the highway. They find their customers in the military and also out of state because because we're very close to D.C. and Maryland, which regulate the car title and payday lenders much more strictly than does Virginia.
Over the decades, SFDC has directed about $2 billion of private investment to this part of the highway, and it shows. Sure, some aging strip malls remain, but there's modern retail now too. A Starbucks drive-thru, landscaping and neighborhood signs to help the newcomers keep straight the PennDOT from Hybla Valley. There's also a new LEED Green apartment complex filled with local art. The Shelby is within walking distance of the Huntington Metro Station, as well as an iconic Route 1 Krispy Kreme donut shop. Fairfax County Supervisor Jeff McKay says buildings like this one are part of a broader trend.
There's nearly 1,000 apartments that have been approved, are uncharacteristic of what people's sense of what Route 1 means is. These are not your affordable garden-style apartments. These are high-end, highly amenitized apartments geared towards working professionals that use transit.
Sharon Bulova agrees. She's chairman of the Fairfax County Board of Supervisors.
The new buildings, the new development are as nice as what you might see in Tyson's or in the Mosaic at Merrifield or some of the other parts of the county. They're beautiful. And I think most people are not really aware of some of those improvements.
One improvement many commuters are all too aware of is the ongoing construction to widen Route 1 near Fort Belvoir. The base is by far the county's largest employer, with a workforce nearly double that of the Pentagon. Jeff McKay.
The perception of Route 1 has been falsely tied to rundown motels, gas stations, closed down businesses, and crime. And frankly, the reality of what Route 1 is today is quite different.
McKay takes issue with these stereotypes.
I was born and raised on the highway. It's where my family spent their life, and many of them still live on the highway. So this is personal for me.
He says getting rid of some of those run-down motels made a big difference in both Route 1's appearance and in the quality of life for residents in the area.
Route 1 is divided between Lee and Mount Vernon District, and on the Lee District side of the highway, there is no longer a single what was called no-tell motel left on Route 1. That changes your crime statistics, it changes your image, it changes your sense of civic pride. So we set out to get rid of those, and they're gone now.
Stores like Pier 1 Imports and Michaels are moving into formerly dilapidated shopping centers. McKay says bringing quality retail closer to where people live cuts down on traffic. So does transit. Chairman Bulova is a well-known proponent of Metro's Silver Line extension. She's also a founder of VRE Commuter Rail Service. Route 1 is Fairfax County's most heavily used bus corridor.
I'm especially excited about future transportation improvements. Extending Metro to Hybla Valley, and then being able to continue with some kind of rapid bus transit will, I think, be significant.
County supervisors are expected to spend the next year making these Route 1 transit upgrades part of their comprehensive plan. The goal, they say, is to make sure people can get around on this busy road as it becomes a more desirable place to live, work, and shop. I'm Jennifer Strong.
Further down Route 1, past Dale City and Dumfries, is one of the most famous military installations in the country, Marine Corps Base Quantico. The 55,000-acre base began its life in 1917 as simple Marine barracks. As Lauren Ober tells us, since then, the base has grown, so much so that it's nearly consumed the town that borders it.
Let's start with some numbers. Quantico, Virginia has 480 people, 140 dwellings, and 10 roads. It is a tenth of a square mile in area, but within those few blocks, the town boasts 9 barbershops and almost as many dry cleaners.
You know, I kind of jokingly tell people we do haircuts, hamburgers, and clothes hangers.
Quantico Mayor Kevin Brown might be joking, but he's kind of right. There isn't a lot going on in town, not anymore. But that wasn't always the case. Quantico used to be a vibrant place with lots of different shops and streets filled with uniformed young Marines.
There were not only dry cleaners, barbers, and restaurants, but gift shops and dressmakers and car dealerships and all sorts of different things here in town. And I think you probably would find some folks in town that would say that the reason why that isn't here anymore is because of the base or because of the gate. The gate moved from right here at the railroad tracks, I think in 84, to out to Route 1. And so that made maybe getting to town even that much more difficult. But I don't know if that's a true kind of assessment. I think the reason why the town has changed is because back in the 50s, 60s, you didn't have Walgreens, Walmart, Target. You didn't have these other services, and it wasn't as developed.
Since he took office 2 years ago, Brown's been trying to bring a little of that life back to town.
We're hoping to find creative ways to bring other businesses to town. So whether that's gift shops or antique stores, not really sure how we're going to crack that, but we're definitely going to work on that.
Brown, who is a retired Marine captain, has his work cut out for him. Quantico is small and these days a little worse for the wear. Most people outside of Prince William County don't even know it exists.
I meet people and I tell them that I live in Quantico or that I'm the mayor of Quantico. And they'll say something like, oh, you're the mayor of the base, or you're the mayor of the FBI. So I have to kind of explain to them, you know, that we're here, that we've been here for a long time, that we're accessible.
Quantico is accessible, sure, but it's not exactly on the beaten path. In order to get to the town by car, you have to pass through the entrance of Marine Corps Base Quantico. There, at a giant sign that reads Quantico, Crossroads of the Marine Corps, a friendly-ish leatherneck checks your ID. Then you drive 3 miles through the base to the town. Veering off the road onto other parts of the base is a big no-no.
We're surrounded by the base on three sides and the Potomac River on one side, which is a kind of a unique thing. That's kind of our one of our claims to fame. We say that we're the only town in America completely surrounded by a military installation. And I've just recently started saying probably the only one in the world.
To get a better feel for the town, let's take a stroll with Quantico Police Chief John Clare. He's had the job for 2 years, and he's the town's only full-time law enforcement officer. Like the mayor, Claire is also a veteran. He served in the Army for 6 years as a military police officer. How long to walk all the streets in Quantico if you're, like, walking a beat?
30 minutes. I respond to most calls on foot unless I anticipate having to take somebody in custody, and then I'll bring the cruiser.
Do you have a jail?
No, we use Prince William County's jail facilities. We use their dispatch facilities. We use their evidence facilities. They provide us a lot of logistical support.
We turn the corner onto Potomac Avenue, the main thoroughfare in Quantico. Claire pauses in front of Sam's Inn restaurant. There's a huge picture of the Marine Corps mascot, Chesty the Bulldog, hanging above the door.
And that's the thing when you come to Quantico is there's a lot of theme, and the theme is the Marine Corps. So where else can you go where a whole town almost has a service theme?
Quantico's relationship to the military base that surrounds it is definitely unique, but its proximity also limits the town's growth. While lots of development has happened along the Route 1 corridor in Virginia, Quantico has largely been passed over, Mayor Brown says. But he's working to change that.
We certainly are looking to try to find some contacts for folks to come in and develop Quantico in a way that doesn't change the appearance or the feel of the town, but does provide some new housing and help to increase the population, as well as the tax base with new property values.
Right now, 3 new houses are going up in town, and there's some rehab happening on another. And the mayor's working on some events like paddling competitions and fishing derbies that will hopefully draw people from the region. But regardless of how much Quantico diversifies, it will always be a town living in the shadow of its much bigger neighbor. I'm Lauren Ober.
Little-known fact about Route 1, our nation's first president spent most of his childhood not too far from it, in Fredericksburg, Virginia. In 1738, a young George Washington moved to Ferry Farm. The house itself has long since been destroyed, but after years of excavation, archaeologists have found its exact location, along with hundreds of thousands of artifacts. Matthew Schwartz headed south to hear the tale.
Down an old dirt road and across a muddy field, archaeologists Dave Maraca and I are heading toward a hillside overlooking the Rappahannock River.
They arrive here when George is 6, and they stay here. George stays here until he's about 24, but his family stays here for like 30 years. And so we have a big chunk of the Washington story here at Ferry Farm.
Maraca has been director of archaeology here since 2001. It's under his leadership that a team of archaeologists found the Washington home in 2008.
And what we argue is that the place that is Ferry Farm shapes or helps shape the man that George becomes.
Just across the river was the town of Fredericksburg. After his father died, young George Washington lost his mentor, his guide into gentleman status.
And so he needs to learn about 1,000 things, and he has no one to introduce him to.
So he goes into town, and he learns to fence, and he learns to shoot pool. He goes to the theater. He even gets dancing lessons.
This town, this landscape, allows him to overcome a lot of the hardships that life had dealt him with. It helps him become sort of a very sophisticated guy.
The farm's location on the river also gave the young Washington a sense of the adventure the world had to offer.
Every day, George Washington sees people that are embarking on the adventure of their lives. They're going to cross that ferry and get on a boat and go someplace exotic like England or the Caribbean. Or, even better, they're going to come down here, wait for their ferry, cross, and go to the frontier, into the woods.
But before he could go off on adventures, Washington had years of growing up to do, and he did so right here, on this hillside.
So this is the archaeological site. Those stones mark the corners of where the house was.
Am I standing on top of...
You're inside the Washington house.
Wow.
So step over here, you're outside. Which room were you in? You're probably in the passage. You can see this house from every house in Fredericksburg. It's a show house, and in order to make it a show house, they stuck it right on the edge of the hill.
Inside the visitor center, archaeologist Laura Galke shows me a picture of one of the items they found digging here.
Is that a wig?
Yes, it's
hair curler?
Yes.
Galke gets pretty excited about her team's latest big discovery, made with help from Virginia Commonwealth University. The residue on that hair curler shows evidence of 18th century hair powder.
And what's newsworthy about the Washington's hair powder was that it was cheap hair powder. So we're even finding ways the family economized in the use of their powder. They were adulterating it with oyster shell.
It may sound like a small detail, but Galke says this is an important find. It shows how the Washingtons lived in a period about which very little was written.
We're making strides into understanding the nature of George's life, the nature of colonial Virginia's during the mid-1700s, and new techniques for analyzing this material that no one else has considered before.
The findings will soon be published in the Journal of Archaeological Science Reports. Something that's unlikely to make its way into a journal is the location of a certain mythical tree about which young George couldn't tell a lie.
Where was the cherry tree that he chopped down and taught everyone about truth?
We're looking feverishly for it.
It sounds like you're being sarcastic.
Yeah. It's hard to find one tree in a landscape this big.
That's true.
The cherry tree story's importance is not whether it happened or not, but that people were exposed to it and people knew it. Every 19th century soldier knows that story. This is a Civil War battlefield, and when soldiers get here, they start looking around for cherry trees, and they find the pits, and they send them home. And so it doesn't really matter if that story is true or not. The fact that people know that story and sort of understand this landscape in that lens is what's important.
And even if that cherry tree is never identified, there's plenty to explore here. They've already found hundreds of thousands of fragments, and now it's time to put those puzzle pieces together. I'm Matthew Schwartz.
That's Metro Connection for this week. We heard from WAMU's Kavitha Cardoza, Emily Berman, Lauren Ober, and Tara Boyle, along with reporters Jennifer Strong and Matthew Schwartz. And you can hear all their stories on our website, metroconnection.org. While you're there, you can find an interactive map of Route 1. Click a spot, and it'll take you to the corresponding story you heard today. WAMU's Managing Editor of News is Memo Lyons. Metro Connection's Managing Producer is Tara Boyle. Lauren Landau is our Editorial Assistant. Thanks, as always, to the WAMU Engineering and Digital Media teams for their help with production and the Metro Connection website. Again, that's metroconnection.org. Our theme song, Every Little Bit Hurts, is from the album It Was Easy by Title Tracks and used with permission of the Ernest Jennings Record Company. You can find information about all the music we use at metroconnection.org. And while you're there, you can also find a link to our free weekly podcast or check us out on iTunes. We hope you can join us next week when we'll take a stroll through our Hall of Fame with some of your favorite stories from the past few months. Is there a Metro Connection piece that really resonated with you? Send us your nomination. Our email address is metro@wamu.org or send us a tweet. Our handle is @WAMU Metro. I'm Rebecca Shear, and thanks for listening to Metro Connection, a production of WAMU 88.5 News.